This is a No Dogma podcast. I'm Brian Hogan, and this evening I am at the offices of iWire Company in downtown Boston, joined by Amy Sterling, Executive Director, and Chris Jordan, developer in the company. Thank you both for taking the time to join me.
Sure, thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Just to get started, could you both tell me a little bit about yourselves and your backgrounds?
Sure. So I'm Amy Sterling, and I have a very diverse background. I studied engineering, and then I worked in engineering and defense contracting, basically testing missiles, and I hated it. So I decided that I needed to switch fields, and that turned into this kind of meandering trajectory going through environmental management to health and wellness, and somewhere along the way I got involved with TED and TEDx, which kind of sparked an interest in crowdsourcing and how do you build systems that bring people together to take action on ideas or on things that should exist but that don't. And so I got really interested from the health side of the wellness side of the brain, right? Not just are we healthy, but are we happy? And how can we be happier? How can we live better lives? And that got me really interested in kind of neuroscience. I started reaching out to lots of neuroscientists, asking them questions like, what's curiosity? What is going on when we're creative? And from there, I had connected with Sebastian Sung at a conference, and I saw kind of randomly on Twitter, of all places, that he was starting this neuroscience project called iWire, where they were inviting gamers from all over the world to help them map out neurons. And I checked it out, and it was good in theory, yet in practice it needed some love. You know, it needed some explanation of why the project existed, why we can't do this automatically, introductions, etc. And so I just kind of offered to help pro bono, and Sebastian started recruiting me up, and then I moved to Boston or to Cambridge 6 months later and have been here ever since.
And Chris, what's your own background?
Yeah, I've been pretty much set in development for a while as a programmer. I've since college, and I've worked a few jobs, co-op jobs through the university during college. And my last one was at PayPal, and then I was working there when I ended up moving to iWire shortly after getting out of school. And what I was looking for was being always interested in going to work and the problems that you're working on. And so I'm not that picky in that that everything needs to be great, but just something, either the programming problem needs to be interesting, or the reason for why you're doing it has to be good. And
yeah, that's pretty common for us developers.
Yeah, my background, other than being a developer, neuroscience specifically isn't something that I've only cared about, but I find it very interesting, and there's tons of exciting work to do here.
How would you describe iWire? What is it?
Do you want to describe iWire, Chris?
I would describe it as a citizen science game that was built from an existing lab tool, and it contributes to tracing neurons that were gathered from various data sets after they were segmented by an artificial intelligence. So that's a long definition.
That's a good definition.
It depends on how deep you want to go into what iWire is.
What does it mean, let's say, for a layperson?
I'd say for a layperson, so iWire started at a computational neuroscience lab, which was originally at MIT, Sebastian Sung's lab, and it's now at Princeton. And they were trying to build software that automatically mapped out neurons. That's important because, you know, we don't know how many types of cells there are in the brain. We don't know consequentially how those cells are connected through their synapses. But we do know that there are a lot of them. There's 80 billion neurons in a human brain, and there's about 100 trillion synapses in a single human brain.
A synapse is a connection between neurons?
Is a junction, yeah, a connection between neurons. And if we want to understand how things that happen in the outside world, outside the brain, things that you see or experience or hear, conversations that you have, how those get translated into things that the brain understands, you need to know what cells are firing when and what that pathway of connectivity looks like and how it changes over time as you learn new information. A big hurdle to asking these questions is data analysis. So kind of a catch-22 of the modern era is that we have created incredible technology to image the brain faster at higher resolution than ever possible, but we don't have the software to derive insights automatically from that image data. And so Sebastian and his lab kind of built this lab software, like Chris was talking about, that it works off the output of artificial intelligence that kind of segments out the data set. You might think of neurons as kind of like these big, they look like trees. And in the same way that plants in the plant kingdom, some are shrubs and some are gigantic redwoods, there's lots of different types of neurons. There are different sizes, there are different shapes. Different trees grow in different places, right? You don't see palm trees in the Arctic. You know, you see certain neurons appearing in specific parts of the brain. And so this the software is semi-automatic in that it, before using any artificial intelligence, you know, the way that you would reconstruct a neuron from like a stack of images, it would take about 1,000 hours of expert human time.
And sorry, for one neuron.
For one neuron.
One neuron. And
for one
How many in the brain you said approximately?
There's 80 billion in one human brain. Now, so what we do is we tackle small data sets from within the mouse, not the human just yet, and at least in our case. But so after actually building the software, it became much faster, about 80 hours of expert human time.
For one neuron.
Yeah, for one neuron, which is a huge improvement, right? But it's still pretty slow, you know? So Sebastian kind of drew inspiration from some other fields. So this idea of citizen science, you know, can you turn lab software into something that the general public can play? There's great examples in projects like Foldit, the protein folding game. And then, you know, just drawing from that, we kind of, there was a prototype that was put online and some people kind of started to play and there was huge resistance, I guess, from it. At MIT, I literally had someone tell me that we do PR, not science, before it was successful. But that project, iWire, launched in 2012, and now we have about 250,000 players from, 145 countries? Do you know how many countries we have now?
Chris is shaking his head.
I'm sorry.
We have a lot of people from a lot of countries who are incredibly active. I mean, our top players will spend like 20, 30 plus hours a week in the game, solving these 3D puzzles. And as they're solving puzzles, it's kind of like, so on the screen in iWire, you have on the right-hand side, you have a cross-section, like a flat 2D image. And on the left, you have this 3D cube. You can scroll through the cube, and as you scroll through, you see these cross-sections, and you see the outlines of neurons, which you could imagine like a tree branch. If you looked at the outline of a tree branch, it'd look kind of like a circle or an oval. That's what the neurons look like if you see a cross-section. And typically in iWire, when you open up a cube, you'll see like a neuron branch that looks like a tree branch that's snapped off, that has kind of a jagged edge. And what the players are trying to do is map the branch from one side of the cube to the other. And they do this by interacting with the output of the AI, which I'm sure Chris will talk more about later. But in the game, you're adding these little 3D puzzle pieces, like little smooth virtual Legos. And when you think you've found all the missing pieces, and you hit submit, and the system will cross-reference what you did with the actions of other highly accurate players. So that's a general iWire in a nutshell.
I come from some years ago. I remember a thing called SETI at home, where it was the processing power of my computer that was being used. Whereas now you're asking people to get involved, and you couldn't do this with processing power, is what I'm guessing. Or at the moment you couldn't, so you're relying on the human element.
That is true. Even though we do require, or our game is slightly demanding on their computers, so they still require some processing, but all the decisions are purely human-based.
Is it demanding from a graphical perspective, or is it doing processing as well?
It's mostly graphics and the data. Is we have quite a lot of data that we're running, and we're doing some processing on their computers on that data.
I mean, iWire, I think, draws a nice parallel to what I kind of see as like a future of AI, that it's not humans or machines, it's not humans versus machines, it's humans with machine learning, right? I mean, in our case, the humans are working with the output of AI, and they're adding human insight to see if something looks right, if it looks wrong, in these edge cases that the AI is not able to do automatically.
So can you talk about the AI components?
Yes. So I'm not directly involved with programming the AI. I'm mostly dealing with what it produces. But as far as the AI, it's built with, it's a pipeline of various processes, but most, I guess one of the most talked about steps is our neural networks, which take the image or the raw image and ultimately work towards, after a few processes after that, it's generating basically groups of, well, we deal with 3D, so instead of having pixels, we refer to them as voxels. So
3D pixels.
Which, yeah. Yep. And so we ultimately, the AI is trying to group 3D pixels together as being part or as being part of the same neuron. Mm-hmm. And then from that, we have players that connect those pieces together to grow the entire neuron. And the AI is currently tuned so that it is very cautious when it is trying to figure out what belongs together, because our game allows people to easily add things together but not break apart the individual pieces.
Is the goal to get to the point where you don't need the people and the AI could have learned enough and do most of it by itself?
Yes. So I say that our goal is to put ourselves out of business.
Okay.
And to make this fully automated, but it's going to be a long time.
Yeah. How far along are you with this?
Yeah.
Or what's preventing you from doing it now?
Development time, resources.
It's basically stressing all the aspects of a computer, from the data to the CPU processing that needs. And there's so much data that I don't even know. It would cost a lot of money just to store everything. And then to run it, we're very far off. We have a really... I'm not sure what...
I think we're allowed to talk about it.
Sure. I think you're allowed to talk about
it. It's public in that, I guess, in that... So a really big challenge is doing a cubic millimeter of a brain.
Oh, yeah. One whole cubic millimeter.
It doesn't sound like much to me, but I'm sure it is.
That's about a billion synapses and 100,000 neurons, roughly.
Okay.
In many years of iWire and 6+ years of analyzing this data set, we've reconstructed a few thousand neurons for perspective.
With all the gamers?
Yeah.
Okay. So far less than a cubic millimeter thus far.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Orders of magnitude less. Yeah, but I mean, I guess another hurdle is, I mean, as we continue to improve machine learning, the edge cases that it's not able to automatically detect get harder and harder. So, you know, say your AI is, you know, 10 times better than it was, or 100 times better than it was. Great, that means you can tackle a much larger data set, but it's still not perfect. And as it incrementally improves, the things that it's unable to do become harder. And so that's why I think kind of, you know, in the longer run, the expert neuron tracers that are the power players in iWire are going to get to play a greater role in the future of reconstructing neurons, because really they're going to be the only ones who are able to say to do what the computer can't.
Yeah. And the bigger, I guess the more data, or the bigger area of data that we're reconstructing, the more critical it is that that the accuracy is high, because a single break is gonna, you know, the greater the distance that you need a path that is perfect.
A path and distance being along a neuron branch.
Yeah, the more the chance that, you know, or the more like the more number of errors that you can have. So basically the accuracy should be higher if you want to reconstruct a larger area. And I think another really big challenge is just using the results of this data. I mean, analyzing yeah. The neurons that we've reconstructed is a challenge, mm-hmm. and analyzing every single one in the brain would be very difficult. You'd probably need an AI that is running just on the output of what we produce to figure out what we even created.
Yeah, I mean, so our academic collaborators are now Sung Lab at Princeton primarily, and basically there are a number of, it's a large lab of about 40 people, and a lot of the development is focused on ingesting new images, aligning those images, training new machine learning on new data sets. But then there's a whole other subset of people. So then, you know, eventually stuff goes into iWire, and the gamers map out all these completed neurons. They start at the soma, at the cell body, and they go all the way out to the ends of the branches of the dendrites. And they check it over and say, okay, the cell is complete. Then we pipe that cell over to Princeton, and there's a whole other set of people who are just trying to identify synapses, classify cells, come up with new classification schemas for cells, model the electrical activity that happens in cells. So in iWire, we're focused on the morphology, on the 3D structure of neurons. But our partner labs, and you know, in the case of iWire, just general scientific consensus provides us with a lot of information about the firing patterns of activity that are in these neurons. And so if you combine activity with structure, with connectivity, that allows you to actually then model mathematically how the neurons compute information. That's a very difficult task. So there's people at Princeton who focus pretty much on that.
I didn't ask you, though, to what end?
To what end?
Yeah,
to great. What end
you've
do
mapped
we want
the
to
neuron,
understand
they,
neuron? I mean,
yeah,
why do we want to understand the world?
But what is the, once you understand a neuron, how does that help? What can you tell when you've understood 10 neurons or 10 million neurons? What's the ultimate goal of it?
Well, I mean, we want to ultimately understand how we are who we are, right? I mean, we're investigating the organ that allows us to investigate in the first place, the brain. And we know embarrassingly little about how it works. We don't even know how many types of cells there are in the brain. How can we not know that? It's 2017, you know, Elon Musk yesterday says he's going to send people around the moon again, and we've got robots on Mars, and, you know, quantum computing is a feasible thing. But we don't even know, like, at the cellular level, how many types of cells there are. And, you know, this new project that we're working on, NEO, this IARPA cubic millimeter thing, it's actually looking at learning and memory and how neurons grow new synapses to represent to recognize that they know something. So it's showing something to a mouse and basically hoping to record new synapses growing between cells that allow it to know that it's something that it's seen versus something that it hasn't seen before. And this, they hope, is going to contribute to entirely new models for machine learning based more on how cerebral cortex works, how the human brain works. And Chris could probably go into it more, but I mean, you know, artificial intelligence and convolutional neural nets, I mean, they're based loosely on like super simplified neurons, and we can't match them closer because we don't know how real neural circuits work. I mean, you could count them on like two hands, how many circuits we know. You could count them probably on one hand, how many complete circuits we know in the brain. And if we don't understand how the brain works, how can we fix it when things go wrong?
I was just going to ask, would one of the outcomes of your studies help with things like Alzheimer's or degenerative brain diseases of that nature?
Not our exact study.
No, but sorry, it might feed into something that then would have that knock-on effect.
Well, what we're hoping is with this to create a pipeline so that labs can analyze their data faster. I mean, a big hurdle to investigating questions is knowing, you know, is analyzing data. This is a huge problem in science, and it's really holding us back. So if we can create pipelines that allow labs to image, align, reconstruct, and make sense of the tissue within the brain that they're focused on, that will allow them to investigate things much faster than they can currently.
What kind of tech stack are you using, Chris?
It's primarily, as far as front end, if I talk about what we built on top of, let's say, the original lab tool, that would be primarily PHP And then the browser code is JavaScript. The original lab tool was mostly C++. And then I'm not sure exactly the implementation for the original neural networks that were run, but I think that's C++ as well. We have a lot of, because of how we are our resources through MIT and the servers that we had there, we have a organization that's a lot of different servers running separate instances, and for the most part we're running everything on our own machines, not utilizing cloud servers. However, we have been transitioning to that with storing the new data sets. So we now use Google Cloud to store our original data set that IWIRE was run on, and we're pushing new data sets there. Even though IWIRE, we haven't officially launched any new data sets with IWIRE, we're still reconstructing the original mouse data set. We are writing some new servers in Node, and we have a lot of separate projects that are built around IWIRE. For example, projects that run off the results of IWIRE, for instance. And those, we've recently been starting to use TypeScript because we have to use JavaScript if we're going to write anything on the web. And so TypeScript is a nice language to use that eventually gets converted into JavaScript.
It sounds like you've scaled enormously, but you said you're not using cloud as such. You said you're using it for data storage, but not for serving the application to the users.
Yeah, we've had access to very good servers running at MIT, and we still have some servers running at MIT, and we have some at Princeton, and we're now running some of the more CPU intensive stuff on cloud servers like Amazon and
Google
Cloud.
Yeah, a lot of IWIRE. I mean, aren't the tutorials served on AWS?
Yeah, I guess
is mostly on AWS now, isn't it?
No, this IWIRE's, I guess you could say, front-end code is still being served by MIT.
Ah.
But the majority of the data is now coming through Google because those are images that they have to analyze for reconstructing in the AI output. That's like the big data that they load, and that all comes from the cloud now.
Let's turn a little bit towards building the community. You obviously started with none, and now you're at, you said 185,000, is that right?
It's almost 250,000.
Oh, I'm sorry, excuse me.
250K-ish.
How did you go from zero to that?
I mean, a lot of community engagement, a lot of catalyzing people to talk in chat, a lot of doing user testing with our players, talking to them, you know, asking what they like and what they don't like about the game. We've also been pretty strong when it comes to media. Actually, this coming summer is going to be our fifth year of doing summer internships in partnership with Massachusetts College of Art. And so this has been, you know, a host of designers, illustrators, animators who have created media content. So everything from IWIRE's logo was created by a designer who is now a full-time designer at IWIRE. We have a number of, you know, special competitions that we do in the game that, you know, illustrators have done work for. We've also tremendously improved the community element of the game. I mean, when IWIRE first launched, you couldn't see your profile, so you didn't know any stats about what you had done. You didn't know if you were good or bad or how many cubes you'd done. There were no different classes of players, so if you were a great player or a poor player, there wasn't really something to progress to if you become excellent at IWIRE. And now there's several different classes, from scouts that look in the overview and try to flag things that are missing or incorrect, all the way up to scythes, who actually team up and work in pairs and edit the consensus in iWire, edit the majority vote in order to fix things that are wrong in cells. And that's principally removing mergers or adding branches or nubs that were not found when the average players just traced the cubes. I don't know, we've really done a lot to kind of engage our community and to also engage the media. I mean, the animations and images and even virtual reality experiences that we've created have allowed us to share iWire with an audience of people who maybe would never seek out neuroscience. You know,
it's not very accessible to most.
Yeah, it's not. You know, it's really not. And there's not a lot of opportunity for people who are not wanting to go to grad school to actually participate in science, you know. But we're now in this totally different time where science is open. You know, you don't necessarily have to have a graduate degree. I mean, one of the core functionalities in iWire is this thing called the Scouts Log. And the Scouts Log is a set of tools that the ranked power players use in order to coordinate their gameplay, in order to fix mistakes on cells, to make cells marked as complete. It's a necessary part of their gameplay, and we did not build it. A player, Gary, who goes by Eldendoff in the game, created this. He integrated what used to be a set of shared Google spreadsheets into the game, and now we're actually, you know, officially going to be supporting it and designing it into iWire. But it just kind of, I think, goes to show that the future of science is going to be really different than the past. And since it is more development focused, you know, design and UI focused when you're building software, there are a lot more opportunities for non-scientists to actually come in and make an impact.
Do you open it up to people to submit your GitHub, to branch your code, to offer an API, things like that?
We built, most of our code is still closed source, but we have considered, or we've wanted to open source parts of it, definitely. We do have support for people to create prototypes of iWire. We have our API, we have a good portion of our API that's public, and we have a API that allows people to basically create their own version of iWire. It does basically the same core actions, which is getting cube assignments, which is the part of the neuron to reconstruct, and also then submitting the results. Those are open as far as an API, and also we opened up some code as far as how, like, a sample app of what iWire currently does, as far as it, the style of reconstruction compared to maybe presenting it in a different way. Also, iWire is, by the nature of running in the browser, it is basically, the front end is open as far as people being able to tweak things, which is how people like Gary, that Amy was just talking about, have been able to create something on top of iWire without ever accessing our code, or at least our Git repo and stuff like that.
It sounds like you've solved a lot of different problems so far with technical things, brain physiology, scale, community engagement. But how do you make money? Have you solved that one?
We don't make money. We make knowledge. We are a nonprofit, and we're kind of a part of Sung Lab. So we get our funding from government grants, from NIH, from IARPA, and also from corporations. So in the past, we've been funded by Korea Telecom, which is like the AT&T of Korea. They are the largest internet service provider in South Korea.
Why would they be involved in a...
Well, South gaming's pretty big there.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And they offer gigabit internet service. And so they were kind of cross-promoting the fact that iWire loads faster if you have high-speed internet. So this is a pretty large advertising campaign in South Korea all about iWire. And then the Gatsby Charitable Trust in the UK has funded us as well.
You have a staff, you said, of 40 in Princeton?
Well, in Princeton, I think we're counted amongst those now, so it's maybe 30 people.
Okay, and then how many are in Boston, may I just ask?
Chris, Will, Alex, me, Devin, Marissa, Celia, and then we have part-time Doug, so that's 7.5. Oh, and then we have Daniela, 8.
So we can count them.
Yeah, so that's 9 that we have right now. Danielle is an illustrator. So we have game masters, developers, designers, me, and and an illustrator as well. And then in the summer, we'll have a number of additional interns. But in the past, you know, we've done work with a lot of different universities having interns come in, everything from science communication to music and sound design. We've also partnered with a lot of different external companies. So like Microsoft Research, for example, sponsored our first giant VR experience that was at the TED conference, or we teamed up with MIT Media Lab to do a different VR thing. We really kind of are strong in collaborations, external collaborations. I mean, you have to be when you're small.
It sounds like you're very successful.
Yeah, well, I mean, also, like, you know, the output of our science, the byproduct of our science is these beautiful 3D neurons that are accurate down to nanoscale resolution. So how can you not want to just share those? I mean, there's, right behind me, there's a neuron laser etched into a piece of walnut, you know, because we can.
So for the listeners, Amy's pointing at a block of wood about maybe 15 inches by 12 inches. Just a standard piece of grain with a neuron carved in.
Mm-hmm.
It's very pretty.
We share our stuff with artists and with designers, and everything that we create as far as media is Creative Commons, you know, because I think that we would not have these cells reconstructed without the gamers, and they have generously and playfully and delightfully helped us make these reconstructions. So the least that we can do is share the output of their work in a way that other people can then go on and share.
Where do you see your future work, and what do you see as maybe the milestones that are coming up?
Next 4 years, IARPA.
What's IARPA?
The IARPA program, this Micron's project that's Machine Intelligence Freak. Oh my God, what does Micron stand for? Machine Intelligence Cortical Reconstruction.
They added a letter to the acronym just so it sounds nice. Doesn't mean anything.
It's basically machine intelligence for cortical circuit reconstruction.
And that's one of your projects that you're
going on. This is the big project that we're working on. So we're
different
next
than,
year
announced. That's different than the game?
Different than iWire. Okay. I mean, because there's more to it than, I mean, there's more to the whole scientific pipeline than iWire, of course, but it's the same thing for this IARPA program, this Micron's program. That's the one that's looking at new machine learning models and looking at Cortex. But for that project, we will be launching a new game called Neo that we announced for the first time, actually, at this Frontiers event that was put on by the White House. And it'll be like iWire in that it's a game, but it will be very different from iWire because the artificial intelligence that underlies the user interactions will be very different. And it's still a work in progress, so we don't know what the UX will be like. We don't know how the game design will work in because we don't know, you know, how good the AI is going to be. But we do know for sure that we are going to launch this game sometime, maybe later this year, maybe next year, that will invite people to tackle a totally different part of the brain where the cells look super different, and to be a part of one of the largest yet smallest brain mapping endeavors in US history.
And then Chris, on the technical side, any large pieces of work changes coming up?
Well, we've spent a good portion of the last year working on technical challenges of delivering more data because one big change is that iWire or the microscopy images are actually different than our current data or our original data set. They are higher resolution, but the way that they slice the neuron is thicker. So that was a big change as far as we're now trying to get more data, or we are trying to get more data delivered to the user and usable by the user at the same time. So that created some technical demands. However, now, so that was just a change in the data set. We also, because of the AI, the AI doesn't just mean that we go faster. It can mean that the that the way that the humans now interact with the AI changes. So we are currently working on figuring out how that new, or how the humans now can best aid the AI. So that's being done, or I guess it's kind of a combined effort by the developers and the scientists down in Princeton to figure out how, what's the new tool for, or I guess we're going to start with figuring out like what's the lab tool that helps, or that efficiently reconstructs the neuron. And then once we find that, then try and, basically launch a new game based on that.
Mm-hmm.
Any final notes before we wrap up for the evening? If people want to join, get in
touch. Yeah, so they could join iWire at iwire.org. It's E-Y-E-W-I-R-E, like the eye, because we're reconstructing a retina, which a lot of people don't know, the part of the brain. But if you know, if you go check out iWire and the brain is maybe not your fancy, there's a whole host of projects under the realm of citizen science, everything from environmental data collection to folding proteins to, if you're a surfer, you can stick a sensor on your surfboard and then, you know, give data to some lab about the quality of the ocean. There's every subject that you can imagine, there's a citizen science project around it. So whatever you're curious about and whatever you, you know, in a second life, if you could go and do some science on the side, whatever that subject would be, go and find a citizen science project around it and go get involved.
Did you say that iWire is going to be at some conferences over the summer?
We will be at the World VR Forum, which is in Kranz, Montana, Switzerland. We've been one of the first groups to do virtual reality and neuroscience. We put the world's first neurons in VR. We then proceeded to put a working neuron circuit that we published in Nature into VR. And now we're kind of exploring how we can bring new realms of storytelling to the brain narrative experience in virtual reality. I'll also be giving a talk at the Games for Change conference in New York this summer. I forgot what month it is.
No, Games for Change.
Yeah, Games for Change is a big one, yeah. Yeah, so, you know, and then we're around Boston, so if you guys are in town, hit us up.
Well, Chris Jordan and Amy Sterling, thank you very much for your time this evening.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
The opening music was A Return by Nisi23 from the album 11 and 12, and the closing music was 6 by Marcel Piquel from the album 1 to 9.